This is On the Line, the price of poverty on 90.3 WBHM. I'm Bradley George. A recent article in the Washington Post put it this way. You have to be rich to be poor. The poorer you are, the more things cost. More in money, time, hassle, exhaustion, menace. In Birmingham, that might mean not having a place to shop for healthy food. In rural Alabama, it could mean paying more for water and sewer service or doing without it. Or maybe it's working a job where you don't have a fixed schedule, so it's difficult to plan childcare or education. These are just a few of the prices paid by the working poor that we've explored this week on WBHM. Now we want to hear from you. Does the recession or a job loss have you facing a financial abyss? Are you scraping by but don't qualify for assistance because you make too much money? Maybe you were living in poverty but somehow you were able to work your way out. We want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-444-9246. You can also email your questions to us at news@wbhm.org. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet your comment or question to us. Just use the hashtag PovertyAL. Again, PovertyAL is our Twitter hashtag. And helping us in our discussion today are two guests. Christina Scott is executive director of the Alabama Poverty Project. It's an organization devoted to education on poverty issues and finding ways to eradicate poverty. Christina, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Ligori is an urban sociologist and human ecologist at UAB. He's also chair of UAB's Department of Sociology and Social Work. He's co-authored six books. The latest, Unhealthy Cities, Race, Class, and Place in America, is due out in September. Dr. Ligori, welcome to you.
Thanks, Bradley.
Starting off, Christina Scott, we'll start with you. In dollars and cents, what are some of the costs paid by poor people in Birmingham and in Alabama?
Well, I think you identified many of them. There's the cost of food and transportation, and there's the cost, and some of it isn't just the monetary cost. It's the cost in time. If it takes you, if you rely on public transportation or getting rides from other people, then it's, even if you work 15 minutes away from your home, it may take you an hour. And I've heard about people taking several hours to get across town to their job. And in urban areas, particularly, transportation is one of the major barriers to emerging from poverty.
And Dr. Ligori?
Thanks, Bradley. What I'd like to also add to this is it's not only that a dollar spends differently in a poor neighborhood than a rich neighborhood, but when someone is living in a poor neighborhood, they're not only dealing with their own poverty, but everyone else's. So there's a psychological cost. There's a health cost to poverty as well.
You also, depending on where you live, things will cost more. Groceries is something that we've talked about this week. The price of food, food deserts is a major issue here in Birmingham. You're going to probably pay more for food. It's more expensive for businesses if they want to set up shop in a poor neighborhood. It's more expensive to do that, and that's why many don't.
That's right. Well, of course, the issues are compounded by transportation as well. But if you just take the issue of food deserts and the absence of grocery stores with the array of healthy foods that might be available in a middle class neighborhood, and you compound that with the other issues related to people who are poor living in poor neighborhoods, like fear of crime and other things, absence of safe parks. The obesity issue becomes dramatic in a case like this. This is why I'm saying that when you start asking questions about what are the costs of poverty, you have to also ask about the physical and psychological costs as well.
But ultimately, it all comes back to the economic, to the dollars and cents cost. That's the beginning and the end of it. Speaking of food deserts, we heard earlier this week in reaction to our story about that from Scott Douglas, who's the executive director of Greater Birmingham Ministries. And the thing he said is that in poorer neighborhoods versus maybe more affluent neighborhoods, the color scheme of food can be reversed, that in poorer neighborhoods, the meat can be green and the vegetables and fruit can be brown. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Scott, because of the work, the service delivery work that Greater Birmingham Ministries does, has a really good sense of what's going on in the communities that they serve. And I also want to point out that there's some great work that's going on to change that dynamic, particularly in the West End neighborhood at the West End Urban Garden, and in East Lake with the work that's being done at the East Lake United Methodist Church with a community garden. And we've seen gardens popping up all over Birmingham. Really, they've exploded in the last 2 years. It's a way to educate community members about healthy food and to really reconnect them with where their food comes from. But it's not the only solution to the problem. It's really the beginning of a conversation. And I'm really excited about the food summit that's coming up on November 12th and 13th. It's being sponsored by Greater Birmingham Community Food Partners, the Alabama Poverty Project, and others, which is going to have an economic development focus, because one of the things is that you can make money in poor communities serving community needs. And so I'm really excited to have economic development come in that conversation to find ways that the business community can engage and eliminate food deserts, because there is a need out there that is just being unmet.
Well, and Christina's point, I think, is really well taken, that the absence of economic opportunities at the moment does, in an area, doesn't mean that there aren't economic opportunities that could be created under the right circumstances.
You mentioned the economic situation, and so many people have been affected by this recession, losing their jobs, having their pay cut. Do we have a sense of how many people, maybe prior to 2008, they weren't classified as poor, but now, because of whatever circumstance, job loss, pay cut, having problems keeping their home with their mortgage, may have been pushed toward the edge of poverty and being feeling some of these effects that we're talking about?
Let me just talk about a couple of things. First of all, there's a long-term trend in the United States over the last 20 to 30 years to redistribute income and wealth. That we right now, if you look at the statistics in terms of income and wealth distribution, there's clear evidence that the distance between poor and rich has grown dramatically, and America is one of the worst examples of income distribution among the wealthy nations in the world. And that trend has again occurred over about a 30-year period of time.
Alabama, actually, if I could just jump in, has the second biggest gap between rich and poor in the country. And you see it when mm-hmm. I drive down 280 and over on 31. You see the big houses on the top of Red Mountain, and then you see the Southtown public housing community. And so it's really blatantly obvious as I travel, not just in Birmingham, but around the state of Alabama, how that income gap affects our communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk about over the mountain, and we don't have a phrase for the other side. But in terms of the trend and the changes over the last few years because of the Great Recession, just in terms of homelessness is an example of extreme poverty. The estimate in this community is that there's been about a 30% increase within the last year in terms of the homeless population.
Well, you mentioned homelessness, and actually we should mention going on today in Birmingham is a summit on homelessness in the city. And in this morning's Birmingham News, there was an article about the healthcare needs of homelessness. And one of the findings of that is some homeless parents say they have trouble getting health care for their children. Many of the homeless say that their failure to get health care interfered with them landing a job or pursuing housing opportunities. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a sort of this domino effect where if you can't do this, then the other things don't fall into place for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Alabama actually leads the nation in access to children's health insurance, but they found that access to health insurance has not had the kind of health outcomes that would be expected. And sometimes it's because the parents don't have health insurance. And so the parents aren't in the mode of going to the doctor. It's something that's expensive, that's unknown, that takes time from your job, which maybe you have work shift work and aren't able to take the time off to go to the doctor. And so they found that even though the kids may have the children's health insurance, it hasn't really impacted our health outcomes.
Part of the cycle of poverty, I think, and particularly in America, is this deep connection between poverty and access to health care. And one of the reasons why America, among the wealthiest nations in the world, ranks very low at the moment in terms of general access to health care has to do with the wide gap in terms of income distributions in the United States.
We're talking about poverty today on the line with Dr. Mark Ligori from UAB and Christina Scott from the Alabama Poverty Project. If you're experiencing any of these things, problems with access to health care, or if you've lost your job and maybe you're having trouble making ends meet or keeping your house, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-444-9246 if you want to call. You can also email your questions to us, news@wbhm.org. On Twitter, you can tweet your questions to us. Just use the hashtag PovertyAL. Again, poverty and then AL for Alabama. Now, Mark Ligori and Christina Scott, you've actually got this map of the state of Alabama out in front of you, and this shows the poverty rates by county in Alabama. And the striking thing about it is there is only one county in Alabama where the poverty rate is below 10%, and that's Shelby County.
Yes, and what's even more interesting is within Shelby County, there are pockets of poverty. For instance, in the city of Montevallo, the poverty rate is 22%. And so, again, you see that gap between rich and poor, where if you drive down 280, you see the large suburban housing developments where there is great wealth. But in the southwestern corner of the county, where there is a different economy, where it's been much more about working in the quarries and working in traditional industrial jobs, and those jobs have gone away. And so now what we're seeing are higher rates of unemployment and higher rates of poverty.
Here's a question from Jenny, actually more of a comment, going back to the food issue, and she quotes George Washington Carver, who asked the question, are we starving in the midst of plenty, and if so, why? And she mentions that Alabama has an ability to produce food, that we have fertile soil, mountains, beaches, et cetera. This is her question. How do we help people understand that we have to lend a hand to poor people right here in our backyard?
For me, it gets back to love thy neighbor as thyself. And so I feel that if I have access to adequate nutrition to be able to put food on the table, then my neighbor should be able to do that as well. And I think part of the question is, how do you do that? And that is a big, complicated question that we're still trying to solve.
Poverty is structural as well as personal, and I think that it's critical to address the structural issues that are associated with it. And the food issue is one clear example of this, that in order for Alabama to better serve the needs of Alabama residents in terms of food, Alabama farmers need to be looking at markets that are closer to home. The whole issue of sustainable agriculture, I think, is a piece of this in many ways. And as Christina mentioned before, the urban gardens movement that's very much alive and well in Birmingham is an important step. I want to address the issue, because Christina brought it up, the issue of religious organizations and their role in this. I participated with a number of other sociologists in the United States in Robert Putnam's study in 2000 of 36 communities in the United States. And one of Birmingham was distinctive among the other communities in a couple of things. One was the extent to which the population says that religion's very important in their lives. It's a form of critical social capital that we have in this community. It's an asset that could be leveraged.
But do people use that social capital to the extent that you think that they would in terms of addressing problems like poverty and homelessness?
It's unspent at the moment. And I think what we need to do in order to start addressing these issues is to ask, where are our assets as a community, as a state? Where are the assets of the people who are living in poor communities? How can they be leveraged with the assets that we have in the larger community to begin to resolve problems? I think we have to sort of think outside the box and think of costs and profits in broader terms than just monetary ones.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. On the 2010 Alabama Poverty Project data sheet, one of the statistics we cite is the number of individuals in Alabama who receive food assistance from non-public sources. And most of those sources are going to be through faith communities. Five times as many Alabamians receive food assistance through private sources than through public sources. And so what we see is the faith community has a huge heart for food security issues. They run food banks. They do soup kitchens. They meet a lot of immediate needs. And something that we're doing at APP is really trying to engage in the long-term systemic structural issues to work with communities, to work, put together folks from faith-based communities and low-income communities, and to develop solutions together.
That's critical, I think, and that's because, you know, one of the downsides of our asset as being religious is that that churches are small groups rather than large coordinated groups, and so the efforts generally tend to be small and not well orchestrated. So good intentions sometimes don't represent the best way of spending the assets that we have, and I think we need some kind of larger structural system to orchestrate the efforts in an efficient way.
Well, I want to turn all of that on its head. I mean, we've talked a lot about charity and benevolence, but there are some people, we've heard from them this week, reacting to our stories and being saying, well, why should I care if people are poor? What effect does that have on me if that's not my life situation?
I think we can take a number of tacks here. One is, if we're religious, let's look at what our religious traditions tell us. But I'm going to set that aside for a minute and talk about much more practical costs. In the United States, there was a study done about 15 years ago of the basic health statistics of a variety of societies, from lesser developed societies to the most advanced. And among the developed nations of the world, the United States ranked 35th, okay, in terms of basic health statistics, things like morbidity in terms of various diseases, things like life expectancy. And the explanation for it that this particular researcher gave was the wide income distribution in the United States was the widest of any of those developed countries. And the interpretation of it was that poverty costs everybody, not just the poor. It costs them in terms of the healthcare system and the cost to that system, but it also costs them in terms of stress. One social scientist has referred to this as an ecology of fear. That is, the way we distribute ourselves in our communities, and Christine had pointed this out before, Birmingham is a classic example of this. Over the mountain, what would we call the other part?
Other side of the mountain, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
the Jones Valley.
Right, but I mean, there's a tremendous cost in our community to the segregation that exists. And that segregation is not unique to Birmingham, not unique to Alabama, but it's costly.
Something else that I'd like to think about is about educational attainment and the economic health of our communities. According to the Southern Education Foundation, Alabama has a 41.4% dropout rate. That makes it difficult for us to recruit in good family wage paying employers. We're competing with Georgia and Tennessee for economic development, and something they look at is what's the school system like. And so when they look at that high dropout rate, they say, wow, the school system is failing its kids. They're not producing employees who know how to run computers, who are able to do the skills that we need them to do in these car manufacturing plants or these aerospace manufacturing plants.
And yet the state is out there pushing really hard for these big mega industrial projects that employ thousands of people and involve complex manufacturing.
Exactly. And at the same time, there's also a lot of effort going on through the education department and on the state's behalf to reduce that dropout rate. AT&T, as a corporation, has made a large investment in dropout prevention programs, and there's a big focus on this right now. But that's one way that having a high poverty rate and poverty in high school dropouts are closely related. A high school dropout only earns a third of what a college graduate earns. And so that's one way that poverty impacts impacts all of us, because in order for our state to have a healthy economy, in order for, you know, for me to be healthy sitting in my prosperous community in Homewood, I need to make sure that there are job opportunities out there for every Alabamian. And it's a real challenge when you have a high dropout rate to have a healthy economy.
We're going to take a short break here. We'll be right back with our On the Line special, The Price of Poverty. If you have questions or comments, please call 1-800-444-9246. You can also email us news@wbhm.org. You're listening to On the Line, The Price of Poverty on 90.3 WBHM Birmingham or 91.5 WSGN Gadsden. We're wrapping up our week-long series on the price of poverty, especially on the working poor, with our guests Dr. Mark Ligori from UAB and Christina Scott from the Alabama Poverty Project. If you have questions or comments about what it takes to be poor, what you need to get out of that situation, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-444-9246 is our number. You can also email us news@wbhm.org. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet your question. Just use the hashtag #PovertyAL. Again, that's poverty and AL for Alabama. And starting off this part of the show, we got this email from this woman we'll call Marlene, who she heard the story earlier this week about food deserts, and she was remarking about the La Camada neighborhood, which is behind the airport. She says, "I have to disagree with the contention that residents of this area may not be able to get to the grocery store to buy groceries, because while they may have a car and may not have gas money, I would venture to guess that 99% of all the residents of La Camada have a cell phone and have cable television. What it boils down to is choice." She goes on and says, "When my husband and I both lost our jobs, we canceled or forewent all non-essential expenditures, including cell service, cable TV, movies, dining out. I also had to budget the grocery money to get the most quality for my family. I managed to feed a family of five decent food on a very small budget." And finally, she says, "I think the story did an injustice to reporting because it was very superficial. I'm tired of listening to people complain about not being able to afford groceries or other essentials while talking on a cell phone. Cell phones and cable TV are not entitlements." Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question is a legitimate question, and I don't want to dismiss it at all. I think one of the things we have to do when we try to understand poverty is to understand it, the cultural implications of poverty. If someone if a family for many generations has been poor, the kinds of values that they have, the sort of strategies they've used as a family over a number of years to address their issues are going to be short-term issues. If you don't have the money to buy more than a few luxury items or goods, you're going to make decisions on the basis of what gives you pleasure, and for some that means that something like a cell phone becomes an essential feature of their everyday life. People do make choices, but those choices are affected by the environments that they are experiences. So this isn't just stupid people making stupid decisions.
We're going to go to the phones now, and this is Alexander.
Yes.
Hello, you're on the air, please.
Hey, my name is Alexander Stewart, and I was thinking maybe that with the poverty, I would say that necessity is the mother of invention. And I graduated in architecture from Tuskegee University, and some of the things that we spoke about was like community gardens and using what resources we have in order to become more prosperous in areas that are, you know, less fortunate. You know, if you can't buy food or go to the grocery store to purchase food, you can grow your own. But if you're in a neighborhood that is underdeveloped or less fortunate as far as economics go, then maybe they could get together and put together community gardens and figure out ways to feed one another. That's the kind of each one, teach one type of learning that the community needs to trying to understand. And also, the community need to understand that if you have different communities with less money, it will hurt because more people are kind of greedy and trying to hold on to the money that they already have. And I think it takes one common understanding that if you have to let go of some things in order to become rich in others.
Okay.
So I guess that's pretty much it.
Okay, thanks for your call.
I thought Alexander made an incredibly important point about the way communities should address poverty, and that's the issue of assets, that every community has assets, no matter how poor. And appreciating those assets, having the community itself appreciates those assets, is an important first step in solving real problems.
Well, that's an interesting point, because it seems in the way that we're approaching this discussion, we're talking about the ways to alleviate it are coming from without or coming from outside.
Yeah.
Outside these communities, yeah. But I think the point that Alexander is making is that that people in these communities perhaps should take a bit more responsibility or a bit more imagination or initiative or whatever you want to call it in terms of solving some of these issues.
I'm going to use a phrase that Robert Putnam uses in his work,
and who is Robert Putnam?
Putnam is the author of a book called Bowling Alone. He's a Harvard professor who's dealt with the issue of what he calls social capital, the social networks that we have with one another that need to be seen as a form of asset, just like our fiscal and our assets and our human capital. But what Putnam uses a phrase, we're better together. And what that implies is that, I mean, it's true that generally when we talk about an endemic problem in a community, we tend to ask, well, what can we do to solve the problem for someone else? What the phrase better together suggests is it needs to be done in partnership. And the first aspect of that partnership is for the community to understand who it is and what it needs.
I also thought that it was great for him to bring up that necessity is the
mother of invention.
Exactly. There's the story of the G-Span quilters in Wilcox County, which is one of the poorest counties in Alabama, one of the poorest counties in America. And they started making quilts out of old clothes, just the scraps of old clothes that were no longer suitable to wear, and made these amazing quilts that have ended up in museums. There's one in the Birmingham Museum of Art. And then I got my Pottery Barn catalog this week, and there's G-Span quilts in the Pottery Barn catalog.
And the real thing, not made in the Philippines or something.
I believe that they're the real thing. I haven't gotten online and done all the research, but it says that they are made in Wilcox County, Alabama. And I just think that that is a fantastic story of how one community used this asset, used something that would be otherwise overlooked, and have created this amazing art that is internationally recognized and is now also driving some tourism to Wilcox County. There is a Black Belt Treasures, which is an artist store in Wilcox County in Camden. You can take the ferry to G's Bend. And so they are using their strengths and assets in order to, in a small way, transform that community.
I'm Bradley George, and this is On the Line on 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. We're talking about the price of poverty today with Christina Scott from the Alabama Poverty Project and Dr. Mark Liguori from UAB. If you have questions or comments, you can call 1-800-444-9246. Again, 1-800-444-9246. You can also send us email to news@wbhm.org. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet your question to us using the hashtag PovertyAL. Christina Scott, we talk about the working poor and people who make too much money to qualify for certain types of assistance. If you fall into that category, what sort of recourse is there for you beyond just getting a job and trying to save as much as you can?
Well, I think that that's also where folks do rely on non-public sources of assistance. And so a faith community might not have the same income guidelines that a public source of assistance like food stamps has. Food stamps are actually very difficult to get. and it can be a very complicated process. And so folks who fall just outside the guidelines will instead go to church food banks. And there's other sources of assistance like Angel Food Ministries, which is a ministry that where you can buy a box of food that is delivered to a church perhaps close to your neighborhood at a low cost. And so it's one way of dealing with living in a food desert and having some certainty in your food budget. And I also think people are creative and figure out how to do without or where to get free meals elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I have AmeriCorps Vistas who work in my office. They're people who work at the poverty level for 1 year to in order to help end poverty in America. It's kind of like a Peace Corps for America. And I'll tell you, they are very creative in where to find free meals and how to find other sources of assistance. But it really, it takes time and it's exhausting. Right. And it may impact your long-term asset development. And I think that's really one of the issues is when you're stuck in a cycle of poverty, you don't have the excess capital to build long-term assets.
I just want to jump in for 1 second and say that if people are having to solve these problems one at a time rather than having some sort of organization of volunteers that could coordinate and orchestrate this, it would reduce the kinds of difficulties that the working poor have. And again, I think this is an important thing to consider in our community and our state is how could we better orchestrate the gaps in services and in the needs that we have. One good example of that is the homeless service agencies in Birmingham every year do a gaps analysis. They come together as a group and then they decide as a group what the needs are and how they may be more efficiently addressed.
Let's go back to the phones now. We're going to Jason in Birmingham. Hello, Jason. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to make a comment in relation to the poverty issue that a person can go through college, and in my case, all the way through a master's degree program, and never have a single class on managing personal finance. And having worked with disadvantaged children and watched them grow into adults, I've seen that problem in that people don't know how to manage their own money. It's an epidemic for America, really, not just poverty. But I don't know what could be done along those lines. But I think at the high school level, maybe even having some sort of class to teach people how to prioritize and better manage their personal finances. You know, not saying that's the reason people are poor, but people just need to know how to do that and maybe some help along those lines.
Okay, Jason, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
So financial literacy, I mean, does that play a part in the woes of the working poor and poor people in general?
I think it pays a part in every one of our lives. And I think Jason's, you know, making an important point that we one piece of what we need to do is think about how we educate kids for the 21st century. I know universities are asking that question, and we're talking about literacy in a whole bunch of different ways than we had before. The notion of quantitative literacy and financial literacy. I think everything ought to be on the table, Jason shouldn't be apologetic for asking the question the way he did. I thought it was an important point.
Well, you know, I was at a meeting yesterday at UAB with folks who work with first-generation college students, and that's one of the issues they raised is one of the most important things for first-generation college students. You get to college, you get all these credit card offers, you're out of the house for the first time, and it's the beginning of starting to manage your own money, and it can be overwhelming, and we don't teach it in school. It's been identified as a major issue for low-income and first-generation college students, and so I think we're seeing that recognition, and we're just at the beginning of figuring out how to deal with it.
1-800-444-9246 is the number if you have a question or comment about the price of poverty in Alabama. We're going to go back to the phones now to Sharon in Vestavia. Sharon, you're on the air.
I'm just so glad you're doing this program. I appreciate the comments that you're making. I think more attention should be paid to the fact that there are so many working poor in Alabama or underemployed people in our state. We have so little benefit for them, and it's very disheartening to see people work and they didn't qualify for food stamps or they don't qualify for any kind of help, but they can't get health care, or they, I just have seen it happen. I've worked in counties other than Jefferson County as an educator. I've seen, I think people will have technology sometimes, but they can't get to where their skills can be applied. I think there's a number of questions that this program could go on for 3 hours and not address everything.
All right, Sharon, thanks for your comments.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the number is 1-800-444-9246. You can also send us email or at news@wbhm.org. You can tweet your question, use the hashtag PovertyAL. And we actually got a question from Twitter. Someone asking about the relationship between the lack of decent public transportation in Birmingham and systemic poverty.
Transportation has been identified as one of the major barriers to economic security in urban areas, because if you, housing tends to be in one part of town, jobs in another. And so if there's a lack of adequate public transportation, it's hard to get from one place to another. In Alabama, we can't use gas tax money like many other states for public transportation. There was a constitutional amendment in the 1950s which banned the use of gas and use tax money for public transportation. And so as a result, we've got a patchwork of public transportation, not just in Birmingham, but throughout the state. And, you know, the University of Alabama on campus actually has one of the best public transportation systems in the entire state, because they run it through through the university, through the tuition and fees from the university. And so I think that that is kind of surprising and an indicator of where we are in the rest of the state.
The one issue that I wanted to raise, and I think it's related to the transportation issue, is that one of the major trends in the United States over the last 30 years, in addition to the income, the widening of the income gap, has been the growth of what are called high poverty ghettos in the United States. In the last 30 years, the number of communities, neighborhoods in the United States where 40% of the residents are below the poverty level and the majority of people are of a minority group, has more than doubled, and the number of minorities in those areas has more than doubled over time. And what's happened in the process is jobs have left those areas entirely. And in communities like Birmingham, where the public transportation system is extremely stressed and limited, all that means essentially is that poverty gets worse in the process. We're not only experiencing everybody else's poverty, we're not living in the same kinds of neighborhoods that we used to live in, where there were jobs, even though they may have been low-wage jobs. The jobs have left those communities.
Go back to the phones now and to Lisa in Birmingham. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to say hi to Mark Ligori. I know you well. And Christina Scott is in the same building with me. I'm at Bridge Ministries.
Hey, Lisa.
I've been listening to the show. It's very good. I wanted to go back a tiny bit on back to the subject of food stamps and food banks. We have a food bank here. It's a small one, but a busy one. And the church that houses our organization also has a very large food bank that serves an entire zip code. And I just wanted to comment that I think a lot of people have the misperception that if you get food stamps, you're covered, and that people are receiving large amounts of money to spend on food. And I just wanted to say that that's not only not true, that food stamps covers the food needs for a family if you get them, but disabled people, for example, who are at the lowest part of the disability income spectrum, get between $10 and $15 a month in food stamps. And I don't think people are aware that that wouldn't cover a week, let alone a month of food for an individual. And the families that are going to food banks sometimes will comment to me that they were turned away because they received food stamps. And I was struck by that, because I thought, if you're thinking that people are making it on food stamps and that that's just this huge amount of money to take care of all of your food needs, I just think that's a common misconception.
So, Lisa, I'm assuming that if other food banks are turning people away because of food stamps, you're saying that your food bank will give food to people who have food stamps?
We give food to anybody who has the humility to come up and say, I need food. We do collect information for statistics, and we tell them why we're asking, you know, who you are, what your ages of your children, where you live, because we're interested in that. We are very interested to tell people that we have people driving from all parts of Jefferson County to get, say, $10 or $15 worth of food. It's incredible. And we've even had people call and say, can I come and get some food? And we say, well, have you looked around in your area? And they'll say, yes, but we don't have enough. I'm willing to drive to where you are. And I have to say, well, let me go look and be sure, because I don't want you to drive 20 miles, 30 miles, and have me hand you $10 worth of food. And I say, that's okay, I'll come. I'm coming anyway. And that is amazing to me.
Okay, Lisa, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Something else we've heard from recipients of food from food banks and from food stamp recipients is that it doesn't cover all the necessities like toilet paper. Mm-hmm. You can't buy toilet paper with food stamps. And so it does not meet all a family's needs. There are lots of things that it does not cover that you really need: laundry detergent, soap, shampoo. And so if you are going to really live at a standard of living that we think is appropriate, food stamps is not enough.
Well, Lisa also made another interesting point there. She mentioned the humility of people coming into their food bank. And I wonder, especially for the working poor, if there's a shame or a stigma of asking for help, whether it's from your parents or relatives or a friend or from an organization like this.
I think you'd have to ask those clients of the food banks. What we are seeing is that more and more people who are employed are going to food banks. There was a study done by Second Harvest, which is the national network of food banks, and I believe something like 1 in 4 people who came to an Alabama food bank who's a member of the Second Harvest Network had a job. And so I would think that it takes a lot of humility. You know, it would take a lot of gumption on my part to go ask for that kind of assistance. But again, I think that, you know, I would love to hear from a client of a food bank and hear what their experience is, because I can only guess.
If you're a client of a food bank, call and we'll get that experience from you. 1-800-444-9246 is the number. You can also email your questions to news@wbhm.org. And we're going to go back to the phones to Brock and Helena. Brock, you're on the air. Hello, Brock.
I'm sorry. I'd like to add to one of the points about the assets within communities, and I work in community development myself. And one of the focuses is usually on external assets or abilities and that sort of thing. And what we've noticed is where sustainable change comes from is when there's a fundamental shift within people, and it kind of comes from within. And so when people drop out of their habitual thinking, their habitual ways of doing things, is when they start to access greater common sense and wisdom and clarity. And then what we've noticed also with that, that goes along with it, is that if you're trying to focus on anything in particular, like crime or pregnancy for teenagers or anything, what we've noticed is as people become healthier, and from this internal resource, and as they become healthier, that all boats rise with the tide, so to speak. So you start to see improvement in all these other areas, and then they start to make wiser decisions. They start to get along better. Things just start to function overall healthier. So it's sort of an inside-out kind of phenomenon that happens. And that's why a lot of times groups that come in and they try to just give services or just provide, as you were speaking before about, it needs to be collaborative. It really has to start from within. I just wanted to add that.
Okay.
I really, really enjoyed your program today. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Brock.
I think Brock's point's well taken, in the sense that people who are poor and have dealt with a life of poverty develop an adaptation. One of the ways we think about this is, as social scientists, is we call it mastery or resilience. And people who are impoverished begin to develop an attitude of faithfulness,
People come my way, I'll win the lottery,
exactly,
something like that. Yeah.
And instead of relying on internal resources. Now, I mean, there's a danger in stereotyping here. I think what Brock's point is that there is a transformation that takes place in the process of asset building, and I would talk about that on both sides. I'm a member of the staff at St. Luke's Episcopal Church too. It's the other hat that I wear, and so I'm going to quote from the Pope. How about that? Yeah. John Paul II said, "There's no person so poor that they have nothing to give, and no one so rich that they have nothing to receive." I think that when we start talking about addressing the issues of poverty in this community, what we're talking about is a total transformation of folks internally, both those over the mountain and those on the other side of the mountain.
Let's go back to the phones, and now we are going to John in Alabaster. John, are you there? Hello, John. Okay, well, we lost John. Again, the number is 1-800-444-9246 if you want to call or maybe you have a question or comment for us. We're talking about the price of poverty on the line from 90.3 WBHM and 91.5 WSGN. Here's a question we got from email saying there are many of us out here who are not really poor. We've lost our jobs or we've had reduced hours at work. We're hurting. Why aren't cities or the state doing more to help people like this who fall into this category?
Something we haven't talked about is Alabama's civic engagement. And Alabama is the fifth least civically engaged state in the country.
When you say civic engagement, what do you mean by that?
Attending a public meeting, being the president of a civic organization, writing a letter to the editor. And we don't have a culture of the government being responsive to the people's needs. And so, and that statistic, I believe, is also from Bowling Alone, the Robert Putnam book. And so I think that a lot of those needs are overlooked. The state has limited resources. Alabama has an extraordinarily low tax burden, which means that the state has very limited resources. We're very reliant on sales tax. And in hard times, the state's tax revenues go down. And so, for instance, the education budget is being hit very hard by the budget situation in Montgomery. And so, I don't think that we do a great job as citizens of telling public institutions what we need to be successful. Mm-hmm. I'm the vice chair of a new commission, the State Commission to Reduce Poverty, and one of the things we're trying to do is talk to Alabamians where they are at their Sunday school, at Auburn and Alabama football games, about their visions and hopes and dreams for the state and what do they think they need to be successful. And so I hope that is one way to bring the voice of not just those who live below the poverty line, but those who live, who are struggling to make ends meet, who are the working poor, to give them a voice at the table, so that we can hold government agencies, to hold our democratic institutions accountable.
I think the other piece of it, look, I mean, you know, the economy, as we understand it, the so-called Great Recession, we know that it's going to be a long, hard slog to get us back to where we are. And I think it's time for us to sort of think differently about the relationship between government and citizen, and to think differently about our communities. I think this asset building sort of notion and the notion of maybe some kind of summit for the state or some kind of summit for Birmingham is something that we ought to consider.
Let's go back to the phones for one last call here. This is William in Birmingham. William, you're on the air. William?
Yes, sir.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering if you could speak to the lack of education in the trades area. I remember when I went to high school in the 80s, there was auto, carpentry, everything like that, and I think all that's gone away, and now there seems to be a skills shortage in America for those kinds of people. But even if I want to go back and be a plumber, everything's online, and there doesn't seem to be much locally to help get people into those skilled trades.
All right, William, thanks for the call.
Alabama actually has an incredible two-year college system and technical education program. There are two-year colleges in every, in just about every county in the state. Part of their mission is to do that kind of skills training. But what we're finding is that folks need to have math and writing skills. And so because there hasn't been a focus on high school education, because we've got a 40% dropout rate, then we find that folks who may be interested in becoming tradesmen don't have the skills they need to take those classes to become a master plumber because they need to go back and do their math class. So if you are interested in becoming a craftsman or getting involved in the construction trades, I would urge you to check out the offerings at your local community college.
As a thought to end on, this is a question we got on from Twitter saying the government can do more, but the real question is, are poor people doing enough to help themselves?
Again, I think that's hard to make those broad generalizations. Alabama has multi-generational poverty. There is a culture of poverty in the state, and that culture not just reflects on the folks who live below the poverty line, but reflects on the middle and upper middle classes, to the wealthiest of us, that we have a culture that perpetuates poverty.
Well,
and so there are big systems that are larger than any one person who are at play.
Right.
And so could each individual do something to better their situation? Almost certainly. But to say that just discounts the fact that we have systemic poverty in this state, that it's bigger than any one person.
And that it has deep costs to the entire community, not just simply those who are poor. Deep costs in terms of crime, in terms of health care costs, in terms of educational issues. This is a structural issue, but it's an issue for all of us.
And we will end it there. Dr. Mark Ligori, a sociologist from UAB, Christina Scott, Executive Director of the Alabama Poverty Project. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our program was produced by Tanya Ott. Andrew Yeager answered the phones. If you missed part of today's show, we'll have the audio posted on our website, WBHM.org, later this afternoon. There you can also find the other stories from our Price of Poverty series as well. I'm Bradley George. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.